Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
If you're a farmer in New York State, join the New York State Grown and Certified program to let people know your food is grown right here. Learn more at certified.ny.gov.
Hey everyone, this is David Tatasciore, lead engineer and studio manager of the Heritage Radio Network, and I'm reaching out to ask for your support during our end-of-year fund drive. A contribution in any amount supports our weekly programming and our mission to make the world a more equitable, sustainable, and delicious place. Plus, you'll receive exclusive member benefits like monthly playlists, discounted event tickets, party invitations, and more. So, if you like good food and you love good food radio, throw a little dough our way. Make your gift at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. Happy holidays from all of us here at Heritage Radio Network.
Afternoon, and welcome to Eating Matters, where we talk about food policy and how it impacts all of us. I'm your host, Jenna Liute, and we're broadcasting live from Roberta's on Heritage Radio Network. I recently had the opportunity to moderate a panel at Columbia University's Teachers College, which was hosted by both the New York City Nutrition Education Network and the Laurie M. Tisch Center for Food Education and Policy. And we talked about the intersection of nutrition education and food waste. We had such a good conversation that I wanted to be able to bring it to you all. During this event, we discussed federal, state, and local policies and initiatives that aim to reduce and divert food waste, in addition to how consumers can encourage and support these interventions. Joining us today to continue the conversation will be Julia McCarthy, policy analyst at the Laurie M. Tisch Center for Food Education and Policy, which is at Columbia University's Teachers College, and Louise Bruce, who is the New York City Organics Senior Program Manager at the New York City Department of Sanitation. We'll also be hearing from Claire Uno, who is the Assistant Executive Director at the Tisch Food Center, and she was responsible for putting the panel discussion together. So really looking forward to that. But before we dig into today's topic, I want to run through some of the biggest food policy related news from the past week. And I am so excited that the one and only Taylor Lenzett is back in the studio with me to discuss. Hi.
Hey, Taylor. Jenna. Did you miss me?
I think I missed you, and I think our listeners missed
Everyone
you.
Did.
Everyone
All of
them.
Amazing.
David has been getting real creative with the sound effects lately. It's really brought joy to my life.
Great.
So let's just get rid of that joy and talk about what's been going on in the world of food.
First up, Trump's transition.
My favorite.
A major plot twist, but Democratic Senator Heidi Heitkamp is currently leading his choice for Secretary of Ag.
That would be the Democratic senator?
Yep. Senator Heitkamp is a first-term Democrat from North Dakota and a member of the Senate Ag Committee. She's been super vocal on ag issues and ultimately has separated from the Dems when it comes to things like GMOs and EPA regulation of wetlands and waterlands.
Yeah, this is tricky. I think a lot of Democrats are hoping she would actually turn it down because there is like a super high chance that if she takes this post, a Republican will fill her Senate seat. So it would just be one more seat in the Senate, which would not be so great. So it's like a catch-22. Where do we want her?
Totally.
I was having a conversation with one of my former colleagues from the Bloomberg administration who is not like very optimistic, I would say, in terms of his outlook. But we were having this conversation, and I was like really thinking hard about what it was going to be best for this situation for her to do. And he said, and I quote, "Nothing matters, Jenna. Your world is about to explode. Don't overthink it."
And you heard it here first.
And you heard it here first. Yeah, I think that can be applied to all food issues. So thank you for that.
So moving on to more exciting things, Rick Perry.
This is where I want to be like, I can't even.
Yeah. So Donald Trump has selected former governor Rick Perry to lead the Energy Department, which we all know he famously forgot that he actually wanted to abolish that department in 2011 during a debate.
That was an amazing.
It was a good moment.
They played that like over and over.
I rewatched it last night.
Oh, yeah. Liz, I could just keep doing that again and again.
He currently serves on the board of Energy Transfer Partners, which is the company that's building the pipeline near Standing Rock.
And bonus, he's a crazy climate change denier.
Yeah.
So even going so far as to censor climate change references in reports put together by the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. So that's good. It's really stacking up to be, I feel like they put all the climate change deniers together and put them in Trump's cabinet.
I mean, yeah, like ExxonMobil. We didn't even talk about him today.
Yeah.
Just in a similar sort of a last thing that we'll talk about in terms of Trump's transition, last Thursday it was announced that Andrew Pudzer would be leading up the Department of Labor. And for those of you who may not know, Pudzer has zero political experience, quite like many of Trump's picks, and has really opposed any increase to minimum wage, offering paid leave or health insurance to employees.
Yeah, this one really stung. And again, is like super ironic. The New York Times actually quoted Pudzer from a Business Insider article earlier this year as saying, quote, "Increased automation could be a welcome development because machines were always polite. They always upsell. They never take a vacation. They never show up late. There is never a slip and fall or an age, sex, or race discrimination case."
Gross.
Yeah, so much for, like, the being a populist president so far.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so whatever. Whatever, nothing matters. Can we talk about some good news?
Yes, we can.
Is there any good news?
There are a few shining moments this week. So Reps Pingree and DeFazio are pushing through the organic welfare rule, which we've talked about a lot on the show. This has been a decade in the making, and it has support actually from the organic industry, and again would require outdoor access for all organic poultry and livestock, and ultimately living conditions that accommodate sort of the health and natural behaviors of the animals.
So that's good news.
Yeah.
And hopefully they can get this done before the end of the year.
I mean the final weeks.
The final weeks. Yeah. Yes. Yes. Same thing. Same. Okay. So also in good news, Nestle scientists settled on a new process that will help cut sugar in chocolate by 40%. And they hope to do this by 2018. So I guess they essentially developed a process to alter the structure of science that makes it taste sweeter, but enables them to use a smaller amount.
Yeah, exactly. The structure of sugar. I mean, really.
What a time.
What a time to be alive. let's see.
What else is going on? We've got one more update.
Oh, we do. Okay,
yeah.
Sorry, yeah.
Yeah.
So the FDA has some new guidelines around fruit and veggie juice as it pertains to food coloring.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, that food manufacturers can use color additives from juices and food as long as the food can safely be consumed itself.
Okay, so this is a little wonky.
Yeah.
So this means that color additives can be used from plants as long as the plant itself can be eaten.
Correct. Okay. Weirdly enough, hibiscus and safflower petals did not make the cut.
Okay. Just because.
Yeah, they didn't make the cut.
All right.
It's like dodgeball.
So what's next for this?
Public comment is open for the next 2 months, so you can send your comments to the FDA.
Assuming, of course, there will be an FDA in the next 2 months.
There you go.
Yeah.
All right. So sorry to end it on a negative note. We have got to start getting like more positive in our news updates.
If you want us to be positive, please tweet at Eating Matters.
Yes. Send us, send us some good stories you want us to talk about. Okay. So we're gonna leave it there. You can send those story ideas or discussion topics to us at eatingmatters@heritageradio.network, or you can tweet to us at eatmattershrn. Okay, to kick off our discussion on food waste, I now want to introduce Claire Uno, Assistant Executive Director at the Tisch Center for Food Education and Policy at Teachers College, which recently hosted the panel on food waste and nutrition education. Claire, welcome to the show.
Hi, Jenna. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you for being on. Okay, can you tell us about the Tisch Food Center and the work that you guys do there?
I would be happy to. So the Laurie, we have, our full name is a real mouthful.
Yeah.
It's the Laurie M. Tisch Center for Food Education and Policy. And we are housed within the program Nutrition at Teachers College, which is at Columbia University.
Mm-hmm.
And this program is actually where, I don't know if you know this, but the field of nutrition education was founded.
What? So, I didn't know that, actually.
Yep. Basically, right here, 1909.
Wow.
So, the Tisch Food Center, we've been around for quite a while, but in 2013 we got our new name and added a focus on policy as well. And basically what we do is cultivate research about the connections between a just and sustainable food system and healthy eating.
Mm-hmm.
And then we translate that research into recommendations and resources for educators, for policymakers, for advocates. And we really have traditionally had a focus on schools.
All right. Okay. So last week, you, in addition to the New York City Nutrition Education Network, hosted a panel on the connection between food waste and nutrition education. And I don't think this may be the connection between the two, maybe is not so immediately apparent. So I'm wondering if you can kind of explain that a little bit and what made you decide to host this panel on this issue.
Sure. So part of my work for the Tisch Food Center is being a member of the New York City Nutrition Education Network, and that network hosts a series of food and health-related workshops every year. And food waste was sort of a perfect topic for the event that I got to co-host, because both NYSNN and the Tisch Food Center really work at the intersection of nutrition education and food systems. So this made sense for the topic that we could focus on.
Okay, so can you, we want to get into this a little bit. Can you explain like the intersection between the two and how nutrition educators can apply the same strategies when helping people change their eating habits, in addition to helping people or institutions change their policy in the realm of food waste?
Sure, it's a great question, and it's definitely not immediately obvious. Given, I think, what a common perception of nutrition education is about, which is really telling people about nutrients. I think that that's what folks think of maybe when they hear the term. And in reality, nutrition education is this really wonderful field that can empower people to understand and navigate the food system, which, as we know, can be incredibly complex and problematic in terms of things like food waste. And also to become advocates for change, both on a personal as well as a policy level. So I kind of want to touch on both of those levels, the mm-hmm. personal level and the policy, more environmental level. On the consumer level, it's important, and I know your other two wonderfully knowledgeable guests are going to get into some of these figures more, but I think it's important to note that 40% of the food waste happens in homes.
And wow.
So, like, yeah. We're all implicated in that, and we all know that, you know, we buy beautiful fresh vegetables and then they turn into mush in our refrigerator once in a while, right?
Yeah, I'm definitely one of those people, unfortunately.
Yeah, so am I. I mean, I think we all are.
Yeah.
So what's great about engaging nutrition educators and helping to prevent food waste is there's a lot of evidence and theory-based strategies that can be used in sort of the same realm. Because if you think about it, you know, a health goal like I want to eat healthier, I want to eat more vegetables, is really the flip side of I want to waste less of those beautiful vegetables that I bought and had to throw away, right?
Yeah.
And so this first step of setting that goal is really important. And then the next one is to identify, so what is it that's going to motivate you to help make that behavior change? Is it that you care about the environment, your health, you know, the economics of it? You hate throwing all that money down the tube. So those motivators can be really important in helping you make that change. And then also, like, what are the skills or knowledge or other supports that you need to be able to make that change? So, for instance, let's say you bought some, you know, leeks, but you don't really know how to cook them in a way that your family likes. Or you bought them with the best of intentions, but you got really busy and you have to clean leeks a lot and you just didn't have time to deal with them, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
These are some of the challenges that people might face. So then what nutrition educators do is work with people to think about, like, what are strategies that could address those challenges? Is it hands-on cooking skills? Is it learning new recipes? Is it menu planning? Is it really easy, quick ways to incorporate veggies into your meals every day? Is it something like washing and chopping your vegetables right when you get home from the market so that they're ready to go all week?
So like
identifying what are the strategies that would work in your life?
And then, manageable. What you just described sounds like very, you know, like piece by piece, so it's not so overwhelming.
Yeah, and it's meeting people where they're at. So no matter where it's at, where you're at in terms of like why you want to be doing this and what you need to learn or gain in skills to overcome that, and it can be really tangible and achievable. So that's the consumer level, and that's a really important place where nutrition educators, I think, can help prevent food waste.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also this more like broader policy and environmental and system change. And, you know from your time at the city, the Department of Health and public health advocates in general love this term, like making the healthy choice.
The easy choice.
Right?
Yes. I love it.
So that's creating environments where it's like easy as pie to eat those vegetables or fruits or whole grains or whatever it is people want to be eating more of. And so I think for food waste, we can think about it the same way and how nutrition educators can help make the non-wasteful choice the easy choice.
Right.
And so an example of that would be like in schools where, you know, kids may be not eating all the fruits and vegetables that end up on their trays. The nutrition educator can institute tastings to get kids to try new fruits and vegetables,
mm-hmm.
or advocate to the school principal to make the lunchtime longer so they have more time to eat more and waste less. So these are some of the, you know, more environmental changes that nutrition educators also can play a really important role in.
Wow. Okay. So there's a lot.
There's a lot
of connection between the two.
Nutrition educators were so exciting.
Yes. I love kind of learning about the different applications of the work that they do to other elements of the food system. And I think that that connection might not be immediately apparent, but it should be, right? I think that these are great sort of strategies that can be applied across the board.
Yeah, and I think just understanding the food system in general is something that's pretty opaque to most of us, and it's something that nutrition educators know intimately.
Yeah, and can talk to their to individuals about. Okay, this has been so helpful, but before we wrap up, I want to know where can our listeners go to find out more information about what the Tisch Food Center is doing and maybe any upcoming events you have in the New York City area?
Sure. So folks can visit our website, which is www.tc.edu/Tisch, which is TISCH. A really great thing to do there is sign up for our newsletter, in which you'll get updates on policy and research and really helpful resources. And they can also follow us on social media. We're on Twitter at Tisch Food Center, and we're on Facebook as the Tisch Food Center as well. And I think the upcoming event that I would mention is that this spring we will be hosting the Just Food Conference again. So keep an eye on Just Food's website and our newsletter as well.
All right. Awesome. Claire, thank you so much for coming on the show today to help tee up this conversation on food waste.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and I'm excited to hear what your guests have to say.
Me too.
All right. Thanks, Jenna.
Thanks. Okay, I want to take a really quick commercial break right now, but when we get back, we will turn to our food waste experts who participated in last week's panel discussion. Stay tuned.
And this one's called Casanova by Tom Cruise. We'll be right back.
New York State cares about New York's farmers. That's why we've developed the New York State Grown and Certified program. It's a seal New Yorkers can look for when they're shopping for food that comes from local farms. Customers are more likely to buy food that has the New York State Grown and Certified seal because it tells them that it comes from a farm that follows environmentally responsible, farm-safe protocols. In other words, the New York State Grown and Certified seal tells them their food is grown right here in New York State. You're a farmer with a lot to do, but the time it takes to sign up for the program is a great investment for your business because it lets shoppers know that your food meets higher standards, has passed assessments, and is produced by environmentally friendly farming practices. To learn about participating in the program, go to certified.ny.gov.
And we're back on Eating Matters, where today we are talking all about food waste. And now joining me to kind of get into this issue in more detail is Julia McCarthy, policy analyst at the Laurie M. Tisch Center for Food Education and Policy, as well as Luis Bruce, who is the senior program manager of New York City Organics at the New York City Department of Sanitation. Julia and Luis, welcome to the show.
Hi.
Okay, so let's get right into it. Julia, when we think about food waste prevention, what are some of the proposed policies that are currently in play at the federal level, both from like a legislative and a regulatory perspective?
Sure. So when we're talking about from a regulatory perspective, I assume you mean what's happening at the agency level?
Yeah, exactly.
Sure. So one thing to point out is the Environmental Protection Agency has a food waste hierarchy, and that shows kind of what is the best use of food, that we should prevent food waste in the first place. That's eating all the food in our fridge, like
yeah.
Claire talked about. We should divert food waste, which is specifically looking at donating foods. Mm-hmm. And then we shouldn't recycle, and that means composting or sending food to anaerobic digestion facilities. And the EPA has a variety of sort of resources and education materials that are associated with that food waste hierarchy that you can access that they've been developing. But sort of,
so they're working on like putting the materials out there on these three kind mm-hmm. of tiers.
Yeah, and so those are available for educators, for policymakers, et cetera. But sort of more importantly and more excitingly, EPA and the United States Department of Agriculture, or USDA, has announced its food waste challenge, which it has set a national sort of goal to reduce food waste by 50% by 2030.
Wow.
Pretty ambitious.
Yeah. It is. I like it.
And so they're inviting like community-based organizations. They're inviting private groups, like other government agencies, to join in that.
So it's like opt-in. And what does it entail exactly, the food waste challenge?
That's a great question. I think they're still fleshing that out.
Okay. All right. Yeah. They know they want to do it. They just don't know how they're going to get there. All right. Well, you got to start somewhere. What about on the legislative side?
So on the legislative side, two sort of exciting things are the enhanced deduction for food donations and then also the Food Recovery Act. And so the first one, the enhanced deduction, was a legislative effort that came last year. Mm-hmm. And that essentially allowed a greater group, like not just a certain kind of corporation, but partnerships, LLCs, et cetera, mm-hmm. to take advantage of a federal deduction for your income when you donated food to an emergency feeding operation.
Okay. So you get money in some way?
You essentially
get a credit.
It's different. A deduction and credit are different, but you don't have to report a certain amount of income, essentially.
All right. So there's a financial incentive.
Yes,
is it preventing or diverting food waste?
That would be diverting. So the food's already been prepared and moved on, but...
So
the second is the Food Recovery Act, and that is a comprehensive food waste bill that sort of looks across this food waste hierarchy and sets goals to be introduced into federal legislation across the board.
Okay.
Shall I talk more about that?
Yeah.
Pingree wrote this bill, and it includes...
Shelley Pingree, who we talked about earlier in our super exciting, happy news updates.
Yeah.
Yes. she's a congressional member from Maine, and there are a variety of provisions in there, including standardizing date labeling, and another one would be, for instance, to have a pilot program for the National School Lunch Program so they could figure out how to reduce food waste both in schools and develop sort of infrastructure to get fresh produce that might be what we consider ugly fruit.
Yeah.
It's not ugly. It's just imperfect. It doesn't meet certain standards.
It's beautiful.
It's really beautiful. and it tastes delicious. But setting up sort of distribution centers to get them to schools.
Okay. And the food date labeling, I think, is really interesting because there is no standard.
Only federally regulated date is baby food or baby formula.
I did not know.
Everything else is manufacturer's
is date. It's just like whatever you want it to be. Sell by, Best Buy, whatever.
I mean, thank God, baby formula. Like,
it's a pretty low bar. It's a pretty low bar. So, so the idea, of course, is that because there's no standardized labeling, that allows, that like encourages people to throw a lot of waste or food away.
So it's really confusing to consumers because there's best if used by. I mean, my friend actually texted me today and was like, I have this meat and it says used by today. Am I going to kill my baby if I cook it? No, you're fine. But people just don't understand what it actually means. And because there are a variety of state laws, it's really difficult for industry to figure out essentially like what they have to comply with. And it's, it can be expensive, I guess, for them.
So a lot going on. And I want to kind of stick with this federal, this like legislative process. I'm wondering if you can give me like just broad strokes of kind of how a bill gets introduced and then potentially passed. That can affect, like, the law of the land at the federal level.
Sure. So I'll use the Food Recovery Act as an example.
Perfect.
So Shelley Pingree would have had her staff or, like, other groups help her to develop this bill. She would then introduce it on a committee that's sort of an expert on the issue. And so in this case, it would have gone to the House and the Senate Ag Committees.
Okay.
Those committees would take the language of the bill. They would essentially decide what they liked in it. What they didn't like, maybe change or amend certain provisions, and then decide whether they were going to introduce it to the larger House or Senate floor. Once the bill comes out of committee and onto the floor, it needs a majority to pass. And then if it passes both the House and the Senate, it goes to the president to sign.
Seems like that second-to-last step is really hard these days.
Even getting out of committee can be really hard these days.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So I think that's really helpful for us. And then where do you know where the Pingree bill is?
I think the idea is that certain provisions of the Pingree bill will be included in the Farm Bill.
Okay.
But I don't think there's much chance that the whole bill as a package will leave the committee.
Okay. So they're going to have to find innovative ways to get the major tenets of it through. Okay. All right. So now that we got the federal level under control, I want to talk a little bit about the state level. Are there certain legislative proposals or initiatives happening, like just in general at the state level? And what would some of those be?
Sure. So states have chosen to tackle food waste in a variety of different ways. Some through education. It might be, you know, information on composting, on how to prevent food waste in the first place. States also, I mean, much less glamorous, but have a really important role in leasing, licensing, and financing facilities. So that's for composting or anaerobic digestion facilities.
I'm like, it's a little bit of a snooze fest. But, yeah.
It is. But really important.
Right.
I can give you some examples of laws that might be a little more interesting.
Yeah, let's talk about them.
Okay.
We're going to get the lawyer perspective here.
Yeah, really interesting, I guess, is relative. For instance, Georgia has an environmental education and composting awareness law, and that requires that all teachers have access to composting sort of curricula and composting training as part of their professional development.
Oh.
At a teacher's college, we love things focused on teachers.
Yeah.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
Oklahoma requires its state agencies to develop food waste regulations. They're different across agencies, I believe, but also sort of symbolic to say that this is an issue that the state really cares about.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess Vermont and Massachusetts, which you would probably are not shocked, have laws addressing food waste. They're two interesting examples. Vermont has fairly aggressive commercial and residential composting laws that will be going into effect, have started to go into effect, and essentially in the next 10 years, all residential or all households will have to comply. And Massachusetts has a green jobs training program, which gives money for people to develop skills to help in composting or anaerobic digestion facilities.
Wow, that's amazing. I didn't know that, especially about Georgia. That's like
or Oklahoma,
yeah.
Which need a little good news coming out of that state legislatively.
You have also been working on a bill that aims to award tax credits to farms for donating produce to local food banks. Can you speak about that?
Sure. So previous to this role, I worked at the Natural Resource Defense Council, who has been a national leader on food waste issues, and but also works at the state and city level to get local measures passed. And one of the things was the Farm to Food Bank bill. And this is a bill that would have provided 25% of the wholesale value of any fresh fruits or vegetables to a farmer who donated them. They could claim up to $5,000 in a refundable credit. And it's really important that it's a refundable credit because a majority of New York State farmers actually report little or no income, and so they would actually...
Like at all?
At all.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, it's a pretty tough time to be a farmer.
Yeah.
And so this would be money in the bank for them. They could get up to $5,000, depending on how much income they claim.
What would normally happen to this food?
It would rot in the fields.
Oh, that's good.
So this covers some of the packing and picking and maybe transporting costs.
And so where is that currently?
The governor vetoed it about 2 weeks ago, unfortunately.
Womp womp.
Second time around.
Where's our sound effects, David?
Second time around.
Yeah.
Could you speak to the differences or what was the approach in the second round? Like, were there amendments?
So he vetoed this around the same time last year, and probably rightly so, because the credit would could have gone out of state. And so it essentially would be like New York giving money to New Jersey farmers, like money into New Jersey coffers. You know, we want to give our tax dollars back to our taxpayers.
Yeah.
So that makes
yeah.
sense.
Yeah.
But the person who introduced the bill had worked with a variety of groups to sort of make changes to the 2015 version. And so this would have limited it to farmers in state and made several other sort of important small tweaks.
Cool.
All right. Good to know that it died. Where does it go now?
There are three options. One is, which seems very unlikely, is that legislators could choose to override Cuomo's veto, and that's really rare. The other is that it could be included in the governor's budget proposal, which will be out early next year. And the third is that sponsors reintroduce it in the next session.
If
smiles all around.
If at first you don't succeed, try again. No. Okay, so Louise, we haven't forgotten about you. I want to shift the conversation to a local level. And as somebody who spent a lot of time working in city government. I know that there are lots of things happening underway a lot of times that sometimes this get overlooked at the local level. So I'm wondering if you can tell us about the fabulous work happening at the New York City level. Yeah, what's going on?
Sure. To start, though, I'd like to thank you both for including the Department of Sanitation in the conversation. Very happy
Absolutely.
To be here. So the New York City Department of Sanitation is responsible for the collection and management of all residential, institutional, and agency waste in New York City. So every day our sanitation workers collect 10,500 tons of refuse and 2,000 tons of recyclables from each and every one of every New Yorker.
That's a lot.
Yeah,
That's a ton. Yeah, there you go. Sorry.
Good waste joke. So Mayor Bill de Blasio's administration has tasked us through their One NYC plan to grow our organics collection or organics diversion initiatives to serve all New Yorkers by the end of 2018.
So just to be super clear, by organics, do you mean just vegetable scraps or...
So when we talk about organic waste, we're referring to all food waste, so vegetable scraps, prepared foods, anything, even oily, greasy, dairy, things you may not compost in your backyard, but that certainly we can use to make compost or energy. We also extend that to food, soiled paper, and then any yard trimmings, yard waste that comes out of your backyard.
Okay.
So organics, actually, they make up about a third of New York City's waste, so a lot, so a third of that nearly 13,000 tons that we just talked about. And to begin to divert that material, we began implementing curbside collection of organic waste in 2013. We've been rolling that out district by district throughout New York City, and I'd like to add to your good news list today by telling you that as of last week, we are the nation's largest organics collection program.
Wow.
Congrats.
Yay! There he goes. That's what all of our listeners are doing right now.
Can I just say I was really hoping that would happen?
Yes, he made it happen.
So more than 960,000 New Yorkers now have access to organics collection. Oh. So if you have a brown bin and you're out there listening, please use it. We want your food waste, food soiled paper, and yard waste.
Yeah.
We also, in addition to that, as we roll this out, we know we want to make sure as many New Yorkers as possible have access to organics diversion infrastructure. So we also have 88 drop-off sites citywide. Wow. These are at farmers markets, commuter hubs, community gardens, schools, places where we have staff who set up a table, set up a site where you can drop your organics once a week. All you need to do is go to our website, nyc.gov/organics, look up your nearest drop-off site and when they're open, and bring us your food.
Just one quick question. This is like on a practical level, and it's something I need the answer to. You want to drop your compost off or your scraps off once a week, right? But how does that actually work? I mean, we all in New York City live in fairly constrained environments. Like, how do I save my food scraps in a way that doesn't make my kitchen a gross place
This is the most important question, so thank you for asking.
Yeah.
So, initially this seems like a very daunting behavior change in your kitchen. So what I do and what I find to be the easiest is I actually keep a bowl in my freezer, and as I'm chopping my vegetables or preparing any food, I'll then take the bowl out of the freezer, set it on the counter, and empty everything into the bin, put it back in the freezer, and forget about it until it's time to drop it off or take it. I actually compost in my backyard, but when I did drop it off.
But
the freezing is amazing because you don't get odors. There's absolutely no chance of pests. The food won't start breaking down because it's frozen.
Yeah.
And so then you just have a nice frozen block of food scraps to take over to your drop-off site.
Ditto. I also do that.
Awesome.
Yeah, I just put in a little bag. Yeah.
Gold stars to you, Taylor.
Yeah, thank you. And then we just bring them to the farmer's market, Grand Army Plaza, every Saturday.
They're drop-off locations, too.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Do I get a gold star?
Yeah. Everybody gets gold stars but me.
Yeah, Jenna, what's the...
Yeah.
I would say, though, so not everyone can freeze their food scraps. A lot of people, you know, the feedback I get is that you go shopping once a week and you put a lot of your food in your freezer.
Yeah.
Or if you're very savvy about reducing food waste before it becomes waste, you might be freezing your tomatoes so that you can cook them later, that sort of thing, or freezing your kale stems to use to make vegetable stock. So a lot of people say, my freezer real estate is totally taken.
Yeah.
So the next thing I say is, oh, do you have space in your fridge? Because it's sort of the same idea. You can have a Tupperware or something in your fridge, throw your food scraps in there. You won't even notice they're there. You might want to indicate that they're food scraps.
Yes.
On the outside for your roommates or family members. If that's not possible, when we roll out to a neighborhood, we provide kitchen containers to all residents, so they'll actually get a bin that they can set in their kitchen. And then we'll give you a coupon for compostable bags to line that bin. If you find that having it out on your counter means that it gets a little smelly or you see that there's a lot of liquids, one thing you can do is sprinkle oatmeal or shredded paper, things that are dry and for a composter, carbon rich, because that'll help absorb some of the moisture, redistribute it, and reduce odors.
Wow, that's so interesting.
Yeah. I'm going to do all of those things when I go
home.
You'll
last a week.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my God. So great. Okay.
Yeah, so in speaking of some of these sort of initiatives, what have been some of the major barriers or challenges in implementing these programs?
So New York City is diverse in absolutely every sense of the word. So, for instance, we have the world's tallest buildings and tiniest apartments, but we also have neighborhoods where you have rather large single-family homes with backyards and garages and plenty of space to store your garbage bins. So we, and then, you know, beyond housing stock, it's, you know, we speak every language in the world. We have every work or living situation. So we had to develop a program or a suite of programs, really, that responded to that diversity. That really, as Claire was talking about meeting people where they're at, we're all about meeting people where they're at. And I think also thinking about what speaks to people. So one of, I am just endlessly inspired by the work of our outreach team, they're out there every day trying to help people, trying to engage people in these programs and help them understand what it means to participate and why they should participate. One thing that I have noticed to be particularly successful, actually, is showing people we can produce endless brochures and you know, marketing campaigns about how this works, but I think there's nothing that speaks to people more loudly than the compost itself. It seems to be something that, you know, healthy soil and soil that has life is something that, you know, just is, I don't know, has this visceral human connection. And so we recently were just, as we were rolling out, alongside the rollout crews, we were putting compost on street trees, compost that we made at a DSMI facility on Staten Island, so that it really is New York City's organics turned into compost. And, you know, residents just come over, they're connected to it. And so we had, my favorite story so far of the rollout is we had a gentleman come over and say, I just got a brown bin and I really don't want this. I totally don't want to participate. This is not, you know, I don't know what this is about, but I really want that stuff. How do I get that stuff? And so, you know, then you can kind of work backwards from there and say, I know it's hard to make this behavioral shift. We just talked about how hard it is to set up in your kitchen, but if you do, we can make this together and we can provide this back to you.
Beautiful, like compost soil. Mm-hmm.
What a great story.
Okay, one of the criticisms I've heard about, I'm thinking about the National School Lunch Program, right? And they obviously, we know, implemented a series of nutritional guidelines that made the food healthier. And naysayers, some people have said, well, it's not really great because it leads to more food waste because the kids don't want to eat the healthier food or, you know, whatever. So I'm wondering, that's what I say to those critics. But I'm wondering, like, if this is something happening in New York City schools, and if so, how is DSNY and the Department of Education for New York City working together to tackle this issue?
So I guess to start, we work very closely with the Department of Education, New York City School Food, Grow NYC, Materials for the Arts, and a number of other partner organizations to help schools move towards our collective goal of zero waste. So currently we provide organics collection service to 722 schools.
Wow,
that's about 40% of the DOE schools in New York City. And provide a number of different outlets for or programs for engaging every stakeholder in a school building, from you know, the students and the teachers to the custodians and the kitchen staff. I think I would. You know, maybe Julia could speak to the nutrition standards, but I will say that New York City is an active participant in the Urban School Food Alliance, which is I think it's five cities, so Chicago, L.A. Sorry, I'm not.
There you go.
Not speaking close enough to the microphone. Sorry about that. So we're part of the Urban School Food Alliance, which is a number of large cities coming together to, you know, use their purchasing power to keep costs down, but make sure that we're getting the right materials in the cafeteria so that more and more of this material is compostable. And one area where we've seen great success is banding together to purchase compostable trays, so to move away from foam trays in the cafeteria to compostables, which means it makes that source separation process in the cafeteria just a little bit easier.
Yeah.
We can all go in the same bin.
Nice.
And I'd like to point out that the first one or two studies show that there was a dip in student consumption, and then more recent studies have shown that students are actually eating the food, I think, at the same or an increased level.
Good. So maybe not so true.
No, I don't think that's actually true.
Accurate.
Finding, yeah.
Nice. Okay, Louise, what are some of the other cities that are currently implementing innovative food programs, food waste programs, and, you know, what can we learn from them?
So, you know, this is really an exciting and wonderful time to be working in this space, just because of how much innovation is going on, not just across the United States, but around the world. When you think about the food waste value chain, it's every stakeholder across it. So it's the municipalities, the composters, the groups collecting the material, the generators. We're just seeing so many interesting ideas out there. To name a couple, I would say if you go to Milan right now, your grocery bag that you get at the grocery store is compostable, which makes it super easy when you go home to take your food scraps, separate them out.
That's amazing.
I know. How cool is that?
Yeah.
I know.
We don't need to tax plastic bags. We just need to give out compostable bags. You heard it in Milan first, folks.
and that gets, again, at this idea of meeting people where they're at, because it makes it that much easier. You have this bag already. It's a very easy process to take that and then put it, line your bin in your bathroom.
The easy choice, the best choice, mm-hmm. the easy choice, I guess.
Mm-hmm. I also always call out Seattle and Cedar Grove. Cedar Grove is the composter for Seattle. They've done really an incredible job of compostability testing. So now, as a consumer, when you go to a store, there's all of these brands and, for everything from plates to serviceware to bags, telling you that they're green or biodegradable.
Yeah.
Cedar Grove has really done an incredible job of not only testing that, so actually putting these materials in their piles, looking at them brand by brand, item by item, what actually breaks down, what makes good compost, but then also putting that on their website in an incredibly user-friendly way. And then I would say one of the most important sources of inspiration for us is what other cities are doing in terms of marketing, what's worked in terms of engaging people, speaking to people about this.
Yeah.
I recently saw an incredibly beautiful campaign coming out of San Francisco called Real Foodies Compost. They have a whole website. Check it out. It's beautiful.
Awesome.
Vancouver has a fantastic campaign where food scraps are, you know, it's kind of a silly characters of food scraps, but there's a lot of, we definitely are looking to see what groups are doing to engage residents in this.
Nice.
Yeah. It truly is like an innovative space, so that's good to be reminded of and hear those stories.
Yeah, definitely.
Julia, given our impending political reality, what do you see as industry's role to be in preventing and diverting food waste?
Sure. So I'd have to start with, I'm always in favor of government intervention industry.
Yeah, we kind of all are. Yeah. Here, yeah.
Just because I think they're thinking more broadly about the public good and have the power to enforce regulations or standards. But industry, especially now, I think state and local measures and things coming from the private sector will be really important. And so a couple good examples come to mind. One would be Campbell's. They're doing a lot around food waste, and one example they have is the Just So Peachy campaign.
Oh.
And they had New Jersey, their facility is located, or they have production facilities in New Jersey, and they had peach farmers there donate their peaches. They had staff donate, I guess, production time, and they canned a bunch of peaches into this peach salsa, which they donated to the food bank, and the food bank was able to sell them and generate a huge amount of revenue to purchase sort of a broader array of foods.
That's amazing.
Oh, yeah. I didn't even hear about that.
Yeah, and if Taylor didn't hear about it. No, that's really exciting. Okay, so that's like an example of a food company doing really cool things. What about, like, at the supermarket level?
Kroger, I think, has been a bit of a leader in this area. They have developed or are in the process of developing donation policies across their stores, and it depends on the region. They also have put an anaerobic digestion, sorry, I always say AD, so actually having to say that out loud is difficult, facility at one of their supermarkets. So any food that's unused just goes straight in.
And it just, like, gets processed right there and turned into compost right on site?
Well, anaerobic digestion is a little different, and Louise is probably better suited to explain it, but for a very short answer would just be that it sort of liquefies food to create a fuel.
Yeah. We're looking at Louise. Thumbs up? Does that make sense?
Should I go through compost anaerobic digestion? I thought you said it was stews. Like, I don't know.
Yeah. It's different anyway.
But essentially it has to do with how you're using microorganisms to break down material. In a compost facility, you're doing it in an oxygen-rich environment, so you have aerobic bacteria that produce as byproducts the humus or the compost that's produced, but then also carbon dioxide, heat, and air and water, or the carbon dioxide being the air. In anaerobic digestion, you have organisms breaking down the material in an oxygen in an environment with no oxygen, and that's hence anaerobic. What the bacteria do is they then produce methane as a byproduct rather than the carbon dioxide. And so you're able to then capture that methane and use that as your energy source.
Huh. Wow. Cool. Fascinating. Okay, and so Kroger is harnessing the methane to use it as an energy source. Okay.
Yes.
Nodding. Got it. Awesome. Okay, well, what about lastly, are restaurants are a big kind of food waster? And if so, what's happening with them?
So I think, as Claire mentioned before, in America, consumers are the single largest producer of food waste, but restaurants certainly play a huge role. And I think Yum Brands is, like, you know, large national chains who own
Taco Bell.
Yeah, Cheesecake Factory, et cetera.
All the good ones are
developing donation policies. They also, I think, that's sort of on the, like, diversion side.
Donation policies to food banks, like for leftover food, or and are they allowed to do that?
As long as it's not served, sort of, it doesn't come out of the kitchen to a consumer.
Okay.
Back of house food can be donated. And a lot of companies are also using this new technology called LeanPath, and there are several similar companies like them that help you track and monitor food waste. And so you see at which stage. Is it in your refrigerator? Is it on your buffet line, et cetera?
Yeah, and so they can kind of plan for that.
Plan better.
That's interesting.
I think one of the biggest problems in restaurants is sort of planning and figuring out where the food waste is occurring.
Yeah, and I want to kind of go back to the point of, you know, restaurants are able to donate food, and so I think there's a common misperception, or at least kind of a fear, that if you donate food of some kind to a food bank and it's bad for whatever reason and people get sick, that you can get sued or whatever. So, you know, are there, like, legal or policies in place that kind of protect the donator?
At the federal level, there's a bill called the Bill Emerson Hunger Law, I guess, and it protects you from any sort of liability.
Yeah. Is that the Good Samaritan law?
Yeah, yes. Shorthand Good Samaritan. Yeah.
Got it.
And then at the state level, many states also have, like, a reiteration of that bill that sometimes goes a little bit further. But no one has ever been sued.
Yeah. I think that's, like, a huge problem. A lot of companies are like, I can't do this because they don't want to risk it. But essentially, they're protected.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so we've got to wrap up in a few minutes, but I want to ask you both, for those individuals listening today who want to support and champion some of these programs, what can they do? Julia, do you want to kick it off and kind of speak broadly in terms of how people can get involved at the federal or state level?
Sure. I mean, I think just by writing letters either to congressional members or to other businesses saying this is an issue you care about, you want to see them act on it. I think once people realize that a lot of people are talking about it, it's more likely to be taken up as an issue and acted on.
Right. All right. So talk about it.
Yeah. To your friends, to your neighbors.
To your food companies. They're pretty responsive, usually, to consumer demands. Okay. Get active, politically active. Louise, what we talked about, some of the really, really practical things you can do in New York City in your own kitchen, given the resources that we are afforded as New Yorkers by the Department of Sanitation. But for those listening in other places, how can they either find out if they have similar programs and or, you know, kind of help encourage their local departments to implement certain programs?
So I would echo Julia and say definitely check your local sanitation department or public works department. Talk to your elected officials. They should know. Mm-hmm. But something that we didn't talk about community composting in New York City, but New York is home to, I would say, the largest network of community compost sites in the country, certainly.
Yeah.
What is community composting? That's neighbors composting together at schools, community gardens, on vacant lots, in public spaces. I think maybe even here at Roberta's, there's some composting that goes on. And what we've seen is that this act of doing it together in your neighborhood is an incredible way to show to really engage people in it, to build public support for this work. It's, you know, as we talked about earlier, this is something that people can all relate to. And
yeah.
And I think certainly we've been investing in community composting since 1993 through our NYC Compost Project. We fund 7 nonprofit organizations, the 4 Botanical Gardens, Laurie Said Ecology Center, Earth Matter, and Big Reuse to do this work. And the reason we do that is because we've been very committed to the idea that if people see it happening in their neighborhood, engage in composting with their neighbors, they'll really understand the value of this. And that extends, you know, beyond residents to elected officials and organs, you know, public, people putting together public policy and all that, who are, you know, thinking about how to implement this in their community.
All right. Okay. Well, I could continue talking about this for forever, but we have to unfortunately wrap it up for today. I want to thank all of our guests who joined us, Claire Uno, Julia McCarthy, and Louise Bruce, for coming on the show. There we go. Thank you also to our sponsors for your very generous support. Our show is produced with help from Taylor Lanzett, and the show music is by Tim Archer. Thank you for our engineer and sound effects guru, David Tatasciore. All of our episodes of Eating Matters are available on the Heritage Radio Network website or as a podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe. Like, share, follow, and post us on Facebook, and find us on Twitter at Eat Matters HRN. I'm Jenna Liu, and thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners, we want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awaeli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.